So, this is going to be the third part of my hysterical reading of A Study in Scarlet. And we're going to do things a little bit differently this time. I've got a small vibrating toy that when I start I'm going to turn on. And I'm just going to put it against the bit just under the head of my cock. That really sensitive bit just near the end. And I'm going to hold it on there while I'm reading. And we're going to see how long I can keep going for. So, I'm not sure how well this is going to pick up on here. So, we'll turn the toy on. And then just place it under the head of my cock there. So, see where we were up to. There was the case of von Bischoff in Frankfurt last year. He would certainly have been hung had this test been in existence. Then there was Mason of Bradford, and the notorious Muller, and Lefebvre of Montpellier, and Samson of New Orleans. I could name a score of cases in which it would have been decisive. "You seem to be a walking calendar of crime," said Stamford with a laugh. "You might start a paper on those lines. Call it the Police News of the Past. Very interesting reading might be made, too," remarked Sherlock Holmes, sticking a small piece of plaster over the prick on his finger. "I have to be careful," he continued, turning to me with a smile, "for I dabble with poisons a good deal." He held out his hand as he spoke, and I noticed that it was all mottled over with similar pieces of plaster and discoloured with strong acids. "We came here on business," said Stamford, sitting down on a high three-leg stool and pushing another one in my direction with his foot. "My friend here wants to take diggings, and as you were complaining that you could get no one to go halves with you, I thought that I had better bring you together." Sherlock Holmes seems delighted at the idea of sharing his rooms with me. "I have my eye on a suite in Baker Street," he said, "which would suit us down to the ground. You don't mind the smell of strong tobacco, I hope?" "I always smoke ships myself," I answered. "That's good enough. I generally have chemicals about and occasionally do experiments. Would that annoy you?" "By no means. Let me see. What are my other shortcomings? I get in the dumps at times and don't open my mouth for days on end. You must not think I'm sulky when I do that. Just let me alone and I'll soon be right. What have you to confess now? It's just as well for two fellows to know the worst of one another before they begin to live together." I laughed at this cross-examination. "I keep a bull pup, I said, "and I object to rows because my nerves are shaken, and I get up to all sorts of ungodly hours. And I'm extremely lazy. I have another set of vices when I'm well, but those are the principal ones at present." "Do you include violin playing in your category of rows?" he asked anxiously. "It depends on the player," I answered. "A well-played violin is a treat for the gods. A badly played one..." "Oh, that's all right," he cried with a merry laugh. I think we may consider the thing as settled. That is, if the rooms are agreeable to you. When shall we see them? Call for me here at noon tomorrow, and we'll go together and settle everything, he answered. All right, noon exactly, I said, shaking his hand. We left him working among his chemicals, and we walked together towards my hotel. By the way, I asked suddenly, stopping and turning upon Stamford, how the deuce did he know that I had come from Afghanistan? My companion smiled an enigmatic smile. That's just his little peculiarity, he said. A good many people have wanted to know how he finds things out. Oh, a mystery, is it? I cried, rubbing my hands. This is very piquant. I am much obliged to you for bringing us together. The proper study of mankind is man, you know. You must study him, then, Stamford said as he bade me goodbye. You'll find him a knotty problem, though. I'll wager he learns more about you than you about him. Goodbye. Goodbye, I answered, and strolled to my hotel, considerably interested in my new acquaintance. Chapter 2. The Science of Deduction. We met the next day as he had arranged, and inspected the rooms at number 221B, Baker Street, of which he had spoken at our meeting. They consisted of a couple of comfortable bedrooms, a single large airy sitting room, cheerfully furnished, and illuminated by two broad windows. So desirable in every way were the apartments, and so moderate did the terms seem when divided between us, that the bargain was concluded upon the spot, and we at once entered into possession. That very evening I moved my things round from the hotel, and on the following morning Sherlock Holmes followed me with several boxes and portmanteaus. For a day or two we were busily employed in unpacking and laying out our property to the best advantage. That done, we gradually began to settle down and to accommodate ourselves in our new surroundings. Holmes was certainly not a difficult man to live with. He was quiet in his ways, and his habits were regular. It was rare for him to be up after 10 at night, and he had invariably breakfasted and gone out before I rose in the morning. Sometimes he spent his day at the chemical laboratory, sometimes in the dissecting rooms, and occasionally in long walks, which appeared to take him to the lowest portion of the city. Nothing could exceed his energy when the working fit was upon him, but now and again a reaction would seize him, and for days on end he would lie upon the sofa in his sitting room, hardly uttering a word, or moving a muscle from morning to night. On those occasions, I have noticed such a dreamy, vacant expression in his eyes that I might have suspected him of being addicted to the use of some narcotic, had not the temperance and cleanliness of his whole life forbidden such a notion. As the weeks went by, my interest in him and my curiosity as to his aims in life gradually deepened and increased. His very person and appearance were such as to strike the attention of the most casual observer. In height he was rather over 6 feet, and so excessively lean that he seemed to be considerably taller. His eyes were sharp and piercing, save during those intervals of torpor to which I have alluded, and his thin, hawk-like nose gave his whole expression an air of alertness and decision. His chin, too, had the prominence and squareness which mark the man of determination. His hands were invariably blotted with ink and stained with chemicals. Yet, he was possessed of extraordinary delicacy of touch. And as frequently, and I frequently had occasion to observe, when I watched him manipulating his fragile philosophical instruments. The reader may set me down as a hopeless busybody, when I confess how much this man stimulated my curiosity, and how I often endeavoured to break through the reticence which he showed on all that concerned himself. Before pronouncing judgment, however, be it remembered how objectless my life, and how little there was to engage my attention. My health forbade me from venturing out unless the weather was exceptionally genial, and I had no friends who would call upon me and break the monotony of my daily existence. Under these circumstances, I eagerly hailed the little mystery which hung around my companion, and spent much of my time in endeavouring to unravel it. He was not studying medicine. He had himself to reply in reply to a question confirmed Stanford's opinion upon that point. Neither did he appear to have pursued any course of reading which might fit him for a degree in science, or any other recognised portal which would give him an entrance into the learned world. Yet his zeal for certain studies was remarkable, and within eccentric limits his knowledge was so extraordinarily ample and minute that his observations have fairly astounded me. Surely no man would work so hard to attain such precise information unless he had some definitive end in view. Delugatory readers are seldom remarkable for the exactness of their learning. No man burdens his mind with small matters unless he has some very good reason for doing so. His ignorance was as remarkable as his knowledge. Of contemporary literature, philosophy, and politics, he appeared to know next to nothing. Upon my quoting Thomas Carlyle, he inquired in the naivest way who he might be and what he had done. My surprise reached a climax, however, when I found incidentally that he was ignorant of Copernican theory and of the composition of the solar system. That any civilized human being in this 19th century should not be aware that the Earth travelled round the sun appeared to be, to me, such an extraordinary fact that I could hardly realize it. "You appear to be astonished," he said, smiling at my expression of surprise. "Now that I do know it, I shall do my best to forget it." "To forget it?" "You see," he explained, "I consider that a man's brain originally is like a little empty attic, and you have to stock it with such furniture as you choose. A fool takes it... A fool takes in all the lumber of every sort that he comes across, so that the knowledge which might be useful to him, gets crowded out, or at best is jumbled upon with a lot of other things, so that he has a difficulty in laying his hands upon it. Now the skilful workman is very careful indeed as to what he takes into his brain attic. He will have nothing but the tools which may help him in doing his work. But of these, he has a large assortment, and all in the most perfect order. It is a mistake to think that little room has elastic walls and can descend to any extent. Depend upon it, there comes a time when, for every addition of knowledge, you forget something that you knew before. It is of the highest importance, therefore, not to have useless facts elbowing out the useful ones. But the solar system, I protested. What the deuce is it to me? He interrupted impatiently. You say that we go round the sun. If we went round the moon, it would not make a pennyworth of difference to me or my work. I was on the point of asking him what that work might be, but something in his manner showed me that the question would be an unwelcome one. I pondered over our short conversation, however, and endeavoured to draw my deductions from it. He said that he would acquire no knowledge which did not bear upon his object. Therefore, all the knowledge which he possessed was such as would be useful to him. I enumerated in my own mind all the various points which he had shown me that he was exceptionally well informed. I even took a pencil and jotted them down. I could not help smiling at the document when I had completed it. It ran this way. Sherlock Holmes, his limits. 1. Knowledge of literature. 0. 2. Philosophy. 0. 3. Astronomy. 0. 4. Politics. Feeble. 5. Botany. Variable. Well up in belladonna, opium, and poisons generally. Knows nothing of practical gardening. Fuck yes. 6. Geology. Practical but limited. Tells at a glance different soils from each other. After walks has shown me splashes upon his trousers and told me by their colour and consistence what part of London he had received them. 7. Chemistry. Profound. 8. Anatomy. Accurate but unsystematic. 9. Sensational literature. Immense. He appears to know every detail of every horror perpetrated in the century. 10. Plays the violin well. Yes. Yeah. 11. Is an expert single stick player, boxer, and swordsman. Oh, yes. Fuck. 12. He has a good practical knowledge of British law. Fuck, I need to go. Fuck, yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, fuck, yes. Oh, that was... That was definitely something. Oh. Fuck, yeah. Oh, that was good. So I think... I think I'm going to continue with using the toy in future ones, but let me know what you think.